from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. He is witty, famously caustic, and brutally honest about the world as he sees it. Aaron Magruder, the man behind the Boondocks comic strip, rails against President Bush, actor Cuba Gooding Jr., black entertainment television, and much more. He is arguably the most controversial cartoonist at work in the mainstream media today, with a comic strip so hot it has been repeatedly dropped from individual papers, but never stopped in its fiery, funny commentary. Magruder was born in Chicago. His family moved to the suburb of Columbia, Maryland, and he got a degree in African American Studies at the University of Maryland in 1997. He launched his cartooning career in college. Now, The Boondocks is syndicated in 250 papers nationwide. The Boondocks story began with its young black characters, brothers Huey and Riley, moving with their grandfather to a white suburb, self-described pilgrims in an unholy land. Since 9/11, Huey, the main character, has latched on to domestic and global politics like a pit bull. The comic is neither maudlin nor safe. It pokes tough fun, prods hard, and defends grandly in a world far from that of Marmaduke and Ziggy. Tonight on Point, Aaron Magruder and how he gets away with it. Are you a Boondocks fan or foe? Has Aaron Magruder enlightened you, offended you? On what topic? War? Interracial relationships? Hip-hop? Black media? Is there a limit to how political the comics page should be? If there is, why? And if not, why are they generally so bland? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Culver City, California, is Aaron Magruder, creator of the comic strip The Boondocks. He's published three collections of Boondocks strips. Boondocks, Because I Know You Don't Read the Newspaper, Fresh for 01, You Suckas, and this fall, A Right to Be Hostile, the first big book of The Boondocks. In July, Magruder signed a contract with Sony to develop a feature film and television series based on the strip. Good evening and welcome, Aaron Magruder.
Hey.
Hi. And there you are in Culver City, California, where there's a lot going on tonight. We want to hear your observations on that. But first of all, welcome. And wow, what a comic strip you do in a world where an awful lot don't make any splash at all, and yours is splashing all over the place all the time. Is that what you set out to do, Aaron Magruder?
Well, first, thanks for having me on the show.
Good to have you.
Yeah, did I set out to do that? I think, you know, first and foremost, you set out to be funny. I needed a job. And, you know, I was interested in art, and I was interested in politics and all of these things. And this kind of seemed like the best way all of those interests could sort of would have come together. I knew that there was going to be, you know, a political nature to what I was going to do, and therefore people would be upset. But certainly it was not the goal to, you know, get into this just to make people angry. The goal was to be funny in the same way that Burke Breathitt and Gary Trudeau had done, but to focus on sort of a different aspect of American life. And, you know, it should be that aspect I was more familiar with, the black side of things. And that's basically what it was.
And I have to say, I mean, those predecessors both brought humor and politics into their cartoons and in a terrific way for many years. But today, you've really got the edge, I'd say, in the field. And you describe a moment where you had begun The Boondocks with these you know, cute but devilish and irascible black kids in a white suburb running into all kinds of circumstances, and you were really burning out on it. Then comes 9/11, and you just let the politics roll. It sort of saved you from a kind of what you describe in the introduction to this new collection of Dead End. What was that burnout that you were up against, Aaron Magruder, and how did the changed world post 9/11 pull you out of it?
Well, I think, you know, I don't. People often think that these comic strips take as long to create as they do to read, and they don't. It's actually a very tiring process to fill that space 7 days a week, every single week, no vacations ever. Actually, I get 3 weeks off every 5 years. And
oh, lucky you!
I know, and my syndicate is the only one that offers that. So it's a very demanding job, and burnout is a very serious issue, particularly when for 4 years you do everything by yourself, which is what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And I just got tired. I just, you know, it's a very small space, so creatively, there's not a lot of space to draw. There's not a lot of space.
You mean physically, the space that physically, comics, yes, the physically, comic strip yes, gets on the comics page?
The actual comics page, the actual space you have to do the strips is very small. And it's very confining. It's tough to tell stories. You know, it's a challenge. And I tell you, the first couple of years were incredibly brutal on me.
Just having really, it there really every day and every day and every day, delivering yeah. that strip.
And keep in mind, you know, I got syndicated. I actually got my contract while I was still in college. That's not how it goes for most cartoonists. Mm-hmm. Most cartoonists end up having many, many years, sometimes decades, to sort of hone their craft before they actually make it into international syndication.
So the full discipline was imposed on you right out of
yeah,
the gate.
Yeah, and I was completely not prepared for it. You know, and so it's just really, really hard. It's by far the hardest thing I've ever done, and I do believe it's the hardest thing I'm ever going to do, those first 2 years of the strip. And it really got to a point where when I started having sort of health problems mm-hmm. because of the stress, the deadlines, it just seemed like, okay, I need to hang this up and figure out what else I'm going to do. What 9/11 did, I think, was to give me something I was losing, which is, I think a motivation, and to feel like the strip has purpose. You know, the thing about being a cartoonist is, you know, you're never there when people actually read the strip. Mm-hmm. So it's not like being a performer right, where right. you're on stage.
You don't get to hear the guffaws. Mm-hmm.
Right, where you see the crowd and whether they like you or don't like you, you know that they're experiencing your work and they're having a reaction to it. Mm-hmm. Cartoonists get none of that. And so, you know, it's hard to, you know, push yourself to create art day in and day out when you really have no awareness of an audience.
You know, I'm struck these days by there was a time when not only were newspapers more widely read, but you could pretty well assume that if someone read a newspaper, they would read the comics page. My observation today is that that's not necessarily true, and that you've got some percentage, and I don't know what it is, of people who read the comics page. And a significant one the percentage of people who do not. I wonder if that's because the comics have gotten so laconic and I don't know, removed. How do you interpret it?
Well, I don't know what laconic means, but it sounds like a heck of a word.
you know, sort of detached and funny in a real kind of obtuse, offbeat way.
I figured it out. I used context clues.
Yeah, okay.
I think it's a couple things. One, the paper most people read is the New York Times. They don't have comic strips.
Yeah. Well most people. I mean, they've got a huge circulation, but nationally it's not the one most people read, of course.
No, well, true. But the New York Times is, you know, it's the standard, sort of, so to speak.
Yep.
But I also think newspapers, forget comics pages, newspapers in general are dying. It's going the way of the dinosaur. You know, they don't really appeal to the younger generation. You know, I find it much easier to just get news online than to go pick up a paper. It's just, you know, a generation that's growing up, you know, checking email as a sort of daily routine can just get their news, you know, from the web just as easy. So I just feel like, you know, it's more of a generational thing you know, people about 30 and under just are not avid newspaper readers.
So maybe the
comics page the comics page is extremely sanitized and boring.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, so that does play a factor in it as well.
I want to come back to that, but I guess where I'm headed with that is some of our listeners will know and love your strip, and just by the numbers, many others will not, just because they don't have a paper that runs it or they don't turn to that page. Would you be generous enough, Aaron Magruder, to give our listeners a sense of where this strip was when it began, what its sort of structure and focus was, and the turn that it took post 9/11?
I think what happened was, you know, it's not, like I said in the introduction to the book, it's not impossible to tell stories in the comics medium. It's just incredibly difficult.
Introduce us to these characters and the situation you put them in originally.
Right. So the same. The setup is basically a couple of you know, black kids who move from the south side of Chicago to a very affluent suburb, which is it's never actually named, It's not a suburb of Chicago either. Mm-hmm. It's of a suburb of an unnamed city, with their grandfather, and this sort of fish out of water tale of sort of racial, you know, discord and people not getting along, and all the humor that is to be found from that subject. I've always found, you know, it's much more funny when people are not getting along than when they actually do get along. So mm-hmm. that
was all the focus. Posing that goes on at the beginning. They're posing a kind of a, you know, striking a ghetto pose to buck themselves up. People in the white suburbs are posing and having all kinds of odd and strange reactions to the new black family on the block.
Yeah, you know, and the interesting thing about those early strips were, you know, people always said, well, geez, where is this place where people act like they've never seen black people before? Well, let me tell you, those places definitely still exist.
And you've got these two main characters, brothers. Give us the characters of these characters, if you'd be good enough.
Right. Well, the central character's name is Huey Freeman. He's a little bit to the left of Castro. You know, he's a radical socialist, you know, conspiracy theorist type.
And it looks like he's about 11. I can't tell what age
he's probably him. He's probably younger than that. I actually don't ever officially give them an age, but yeah, he's around that.
But for a visual cue, and he's this cute kid with the great big kind of afro,
great big spiky afro,
and cute, but always a look on his face like he's got the sort of the. He's angry with the weight of the world on his shoulders.
That's exactly correct. It's a sort of permanent scowl. And his younger brother, Riley, is a sort of, you know, a knucklehead, a sort of product of the current hip-hop generation and always sort of putting on the mask of being a thug and wanting to be tough and all of that stuff. And their grandfather is more of a sort of traditional, sort of morally conservative, old, you know, black man. You know, so the stories are, you know, early on are about, you know, one, their interaction with their neighborhood, their integration into school, and it's also their interpersonal dynamic within the household, because these are three very different characters.
And they're often pushing the grandfather. He's often calling them on their on Huey's kind of extremes of BS once in a while.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the good things about the strip is that it shows, you know, three, actually even more, you know, four or five very different black male characters of different ages and different sort of political perspectives.
Types, outlooks, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're just very, very different. And we get to see, you know, that world of you know, not only how black people see the world around them, but how black people see themselves.
So in those early strips, you had all the kind of domestic and neighborhood issues that intersected with race and all the rest. Then comes 9/11, and your strip blows up into a much larger critique. Huey Freeman takes on the world, and with his pals, I'm looking at one here from earlier this year where he's with another friend. I think this is Caesar.
The kid with the dreads.
Yeah, with the dreadlocks. And Caesar's saying, I saw this TV commercial that said buying drugs helps support terrorism. Think that's true? And Huey says, I suppose. Of course, so does paying federal income taxes. Caesar says, probably best to avoid both just to be safe. And in those two panels, we've got a comic strip on the comics page accusing the U.S. federal government of terrorism.
That would be correct.
Hello. This is not traditional.
You don't miss much, do you?
Well, it wasn't hired. You pretty much drew it right in front of us.
There you go, yeah.
How often are you do you have particular strips held out of the paper by particular papers?
That I actually don't know. You know, I don't have communication with the newspapers directly. I talk to the syndicate. The syndicate talks to the newspapers. And we all like it that way.
But you know that it does happen.
It does happen, but I have not asked to be informed of every time it happens because, you know, it just doesn't really, I don't say it doesn't matter, but it's out of my control. So it's not something that I should spend a lot of time worried about.
Well, maybe.
But, you know, it happens sporadically. I mean, I think, you know, it happens here and there for different reasons.
Yeah. Maybe better not to know in the role that you're filling. Aaron Magruder, please stand by. We're talking tonight with Aaron Magruder, creator of the Boondocks comic strip. Perhaps the most controversial cartoonist at work in America's mainstream press today, are you a Boondocks fan or foe? And is there a limit to how political the comics page should be? If there is, why? And if there's not, why is it so bland generally? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Aaron Magruder, creator of the Boondocks comic strip and the most controversial cartoonist at work in America's mainstream press today. You can join this conversation as well. Why does Boondocks look so alone in its hot critique of controversial times on the comics page? And has Aaron Magruder offended you, even if you love his strip on interracial marriage, on hip-hop, on black media, on your government? I guess the bigger question, should a comic page cartoonist be any more constrained than a stand-up comic? Could he be less constrained? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Aaron Magruder's new book and collection of strips of the Boondocks is A Right to Be Hostile. Are you reading the strips as he pumps them out every day? Caitlin's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Caitlin. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to call and say thank you to Aaron Magruder. I started reading the strip when it was pulled by the Boston Globe during the war in Iraq. So I, of course, had to move from the op-ed page to the comics to see what was so controversial. And I've stuck with it. It really makes me laugh out loud in the morning, and it's thought-provoking. And I stick with it. One reason I like the grandfather, I like how he's not mocked when he could be, that he's a sufficient foil without being silly.
How would you, for people who don't read it, Caitlin, how would you describe that character of the black grandfather who's moved his grandsons to the burbs?
Well, he's a very patient person, and he provides them with guidance without necessarily behaving the way other people do with authority in the comic strips.
Mm-hmm.
He's not drawn so large that you can't take him with any humor as well as seriousness.
And he's tough on the kids sometimes, even threatens the belt, but he's got a great sense of kind of supportive humor that backs them up.
Mm-hmm. My husband and I read it together. He doesn't understand a lot of it because he's from overseas. I try to translate things and try to explain it to him, but it's laugh out loud, and I do appreciate it.
Have you ever been offended, Caitlin, by what you read in the Boondocks?
No. I have to say that it's just thought-provoking enough that I don't necessarily run outside and repeat it to everybody, but I do.
That would be best.
for fear of being cut down?
No, just I'm in a neighborhood where people don't read the newspaper, so
yeah.
You know, it's shocking enough to get a newspaper delivered in the morning.
But you're glad to have it there for you. Caitlin,
I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for your call. Aaron Magruder, Caitlin referred to one strip that was withheld by at least one paper, the Boston Globe, and perhaps a couple of others, on March 29th this year. And this was a day...
That was a protest strip.
Protest strip. And if I can describe it, you can see the kind of panels of a comic strip, but laid on top of it is a big box that says Special Boondocks Protest Strip, in which you wrote and signed, in order to express the outrage and the disappointment at the situation in the Middle East, as well as an upcoming movie starring Cuba Gooding Jr., in which the actor will undoubtedly shame himself and his race. Today's installment of the Boondocks will not be appearing. Seriously, folks, let's stop the madness. The Bush administration's hunger for war and Hollywood's continued production of movies starring Cuba Gooding Jr. must be stopped. Signed, Aaron Magruder. And there, at least one paper, and I think a few more, held that right out. Did you accept it? Did you expect it would just slide into all the papers in the country, Aaron?
Well, I expect nothing at this point. But that one, I figured, would you know, anger some newspaper editors more than they're usually angry.
I mean, you're playing with the bounds of the comics page there, right? You're not
no
playing
question.
By the rules.
But part of that is, look, I mean, in this sense, it really was a protest strip in that, you know, it was going to be something people had to sort of stop and pay attention to. The strip was not going to be there for at least a day. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I didn't want to be so self-indulgent that there wasn't at least, you know, some kind of joke in there. You know, so
Cuba, your regular whipping boy, if I can use that phrase.
Well, that would not be a good.
That wouldn't be good, I know. Nevertheless, boy, oh boy, by the dictionary definition, I want to pick up on both halves of that. But first, before the big critique, which goes on regularly about U.S. foreign policy and the war, but you're also you're also tough on a lot of black fronts. Cuba Gooding Jr. is your number one target.
Not anymore.
Okay, before you let that go, what was the bee in your bonnet exactly with this smiling actor?
You know, this is one of those situations. I actually have to decline comment on this one. I can't talk about Cuba.
You've got to be kidding! I mean, after 10,000 comics that trashed this man.
Believe it or not, yes. Look, you know, here's the situation. I always believe in full disclosure. You know, I live and work in Hollywood now. There are projects in development that would make me unwise to be talking about Cuba Gooding Jr. right now.
For economic reasons.
Yeah. Absolutely. But the strips basically speak for themselves. And without speaking about Cuba specifically, I will say, I'll say this about Cuba, which is, you know, you know, there have been movies that Cuba has made that I have not liked, and they are part of a sort of larger Hollywood landscape of movies that are still demeaning and degrading black people. And I do think that, you know, I think we have a responsibility to critique those movies and try to encourage all of those actors, whether it's Cuba or Queen Latifah or Vivica Fox, whoever else I've talked about, to do better movies, because, you know, they are capable of doing better movies.
So don't pin it on Cuba or anyone in particular. But what's the character that you're objecting, and the kind of movie that you're objecting so strongly to here?
Well, look, I mean, it's, you know, there's a lot of different stereotypes of black people in entertainment. They have sort of dogged us for countless years. They're still around. They evolve somewhat. They change. They metamorphosize. But, you know, at the heart, there's still the sort of same set of very offensive stereotypes that have been following us for a long time.
This kind of the shucking and jiving.
The buck, you know, all of that. And when I talk about racism in Hollywood, that's the easy part to understand. The hows and the whys that these movies get made is a much more complicated, nuanced thing. But the point is that, you know, I simply have decided to demand more from black entertainment across the board, whether it's television, music, or movies. You know,
more than the country's getting.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I just think that I just refuse to just accept really bad entertainment. It just really bothers me. And you know, the country as a whole doesn't pay a lot of attention to black film and television. It's sort of ghettoized, and it's something that I think the masses of Americans don't think about. So, you know,
you've put your eye on it and said, this is not worthy. I want to take a call. Mike is calling from Tampa, Florida. Hi, Micah. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
Actually, I just wanted to call in and personally thank Aaron Magruder for his ongoing work. I've been a longtime reader of the strip. I have the first two collections, and now that I know there's a third available, I will be seeking it out soon. Unfortunately, our paper here only carries it on Sundays, so we only get the more tame versions of it here.
So and Sundays are much tamer.
Pardon?
The Sundays are, in fact, much tamer.
Yeah.
That's interesting, because they have a wider circulation, or why, Aaron?
Because they have a wider circulation, because more kids read on Sunday, and because newspaper editors don't see the Sunday strips before they go out. So they don't have a chance to stop something that might potentially offend them, which is unlike the dailies. So they can put a stop to it.
So you go a little bit easier on them. Micah, what is it exactly about this strip that you like?
The first thing that attracted it to me, of course, was the artwork, and I must say I was very impressed. And from there, it was, of course, the writing and the subjects that were being handled. Personally, as a black man in this country, I like the idea that a lot of issues that don't commonly get addressed and can't find a venue where they are accepted are brought to light. And I like the fact that it's done on such an even-handed plane. It's not all from one side. I greatly appreciate the fact that he critiques everything.
Including the tough eye that he casts on black entertainment, on black cultural figures?
Especially the tough eye he casts on black cultural figures and entertainment, because we have to hold ourselves acceptable if we're going to make any true progress, period. We can't look to other people for help for everything. We have to accept, at some point say, okay, we're not going to constantly take the constant, you know, R&B pop culture image that's thrown across the airwaves every day. We have to actually stand up and be individuals and actually demand more before we're actually going to get it.
Michael, we've got it, and we appreciate your call and your comment. Thanks so much for calling in. Aaron Magruder, do you find a difference in the way your strip is perceived in the black community, white community, Hispanic, you name it? Does it break down by race?
Again, that I can't really speak on. I'm not there when people read it. I don't have a lot of interaction with readers. I don't read fan mail. I don't read hate mail as a rule. I hear controversy or rumors of controversy. I do know that black people get mad at things and white people get mad at things. I do think it's more generational than racial. Mm-hmm. But that's a hunch. I don't know specifically.
Boy, it really is different when you put the comic strip out and people read it privately, as you say. I want to turn to the politics of the main character, Huey Freeman. They really get way out there sometime. It's a marvelous sort of a sleight of hand you've got, where you put really hot stuff in the mouth of a kid, and then so it's already sort of defanged a little bit, and then you bring in humor at the end of every strip that also puts a little softening touch on it. But yet, what you write is tough. I'm looking at one here from January this year. And it's three panels. It looks like it's Huey Freeman and his friend Caesar again. They're standing on a hillside, and Huey says, "Soon our nation will pause and celebrate the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. We will reflect on his legacy and his wisdom. Who can forget when he said, 'Violence against your fellow man is never the answer'?" And then the final panel, "Unless you suspect your fellow man has a weapon that you yourself have but don't want him to have, then you should bomb the bejesus out of him." And Caesar says, "Stop that," because, of course, Huey Freeman is going out of the Martin Luther King hymn book there. How would you characterize Huey Freeman's politics, Aaron Magruder?
I think they're fairly self-explanatory. I mean, you know, Huey is a radical socialist, you know, on the far left, and it's actually fairly straightforward. It's no deeper than that.
For people who haven't read the strip, what does Huey think of the war in Iraq?
He's all for it. I mean, Jesus Christ. Look, you know,
he wouldn't like it, but what's his critique of it?
The thing about Huey is that he's not a pacifist, but he is very anti sort of American imperialism, like many people around the world. If like a lot of people in this country, you know, just are really offended at what's been going on, at a preemptive invasion of a sovereign nation and all that stuff. You know, he's a radical leftist. There's no question.
And when he looks at the Bush administration, he doesn't even want to admit that it was properly put into office.
Well, again, I'm not sure he's wrong on that one.
I guess a question in my mind is how far do you slide Huey's views out there? You know, one way or another, he always gets kind of pulled back by one of his buddies or by his grandfather. But do you see Huey as overshooting the mark, or Huey is telling it like it is, and the folks around him who are just not quite as on fire, saying, you know, let us up, Huey?
I think, you know, the primary goal of the strip is to be funny, and part of what makes Huey funny is how seriously he takes himself, and you know that's part of the joke a lot of the times, and it's something that people miss, which is it's the extreme way that he expresses these left-wing views that, you know, is what's kind of funny, much like Ann Coulter on the right. But, you know, at the end of the day, he's often the butt of the joke in a very sort of subtle way, and a lot of people don't recognize it. Now, that said, I mean, certainly, you know, the political agenda that I have is there. It's fairly obvious. But, you know, I don't take it so seriously that I can't even laugh at my own political views.
In letting Huey be mocked a bit, you get to poke it at yourself a bit. Alice is calling from Boston. Hi, Alice. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Great, thanks.
Well, I'm telling you, I give his books to all of my grandchildren down in Birmingham, Alabama, because actually you have to be fairly well read to understand a lot of his, a lot of yours. I guess I'm talking to you, Aaron, aren't I?
Yes, you are.
Excited about that. And many of us here in Boston are so disgusted by the mainstream media and actually the way NPR is turning right that I have to look at comic strips like yours and Doonesbury to get some sort of feeling for honesty. And by the way, the Bush administration is illegally in place, as we all know. Anybody who's read the Constitution knows that.
We all do know that.
Alice, I hear that, and I want to ask you in particular, though, about sending it to your grandkids.
Yes.
Exactly why? What's the button you're trying to press when you send them Aaron Magruder's work, his strips?
I was a civil rights worker in Birmingham back in 63, and it was segregated by law down there. Now Birmingham has become resegregated with my grandchildren and many of my fellow classmates living over the mountain, as they say. It's become all white over the mountain, and downtown Birmingham is all black. Mm-hmm. So just as I never knew when I was a little girl, educated black people who were my peers in terms of wants and desires and ambitions, unfortunately, my grandchildren are growing up in the same way. And by sending them these books by Aaron Magruder, I'm not only challenging those grandchildren of mine to get informed, because you can't understand his thing, a lot of his...
You've got to read the rest of the newspaper to understand his strip.
Precisely, mm-hmm. precisely. Mm-hmm. And also, they need to learn where the grandmother's coming from, too, when she's out there protesting the war. And working for Dean for president.
And give them a sense of why you're doing that. And for you, they get it from the Boondocks.
Yes, exactly. So that's a double whammy there. It's here's some honesty, here's some truth, and yeah, when they censor him, understand it's the First Amendment going down. And we've got to restore the Bill of Rights, and it's people like Aaron Magruder who make it funny. See, I get furious. I start frothing at the mouth. But
he helps your blood pressure a little bit?
Yes, he helps my blood pressure a lot.
Thank you very much.
He's better than any psychiatrist I know.
Oh, Alice, it's great to hear from you. Thank you so much for your call. Aaron Magruder, there's a grandmother and a fan who's bringing you a new generation of fans with all of her grandkids.
That's great.
That is pretty great. When you sit down to write, wow, that's a lot of responsibility to carry. She's out there reading, and she wants you to be feeding her her next generation or two.
And keeping her blood pressure down. Which is part of the reason why I actually don't read fan mail or hate mail. Because, you know, even positive or negative, that strong of a sentiment can start to, you know, weigh on the creative process.
Yeah.
And you just, you know, when I sit down, I write things that I just think are funny.
Well, and yeah, it can tie you up or tie you down, but there it is tonight. It's applause, and take it for this moment. We're talking tonight with Aaron Magruder, creator of the Boondocks comic strip. Maybe the most controversial cartoonist at work in America's mainstream press today. Is Aaron Magruder too cutting, or is the mainstream press too dull? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Aaron Magruder, creator of the Boondocks comic strip. He's out with a new collection of the strips called A Right to Be Hostile. He joins us tonight from Culver City, California. You can join the conversation as well. Is there a limit to how political the comics page should be? Is there anything that two cute black kids in a comic strip can't say? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm looking at a strip here from July 27th this year. It's another tough one. Hugh is standing in a field with Caesar. It's a beautiful day, he says. I don't think I've ever seen a sky this blue, he says. Caesar, did you know Strom Thurmond died over a week ago? And Huey just goes on, are the clouds always this fluffy? Unperturbed by that particular death, Brian's calling from Pleasantville, Wisconsin. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Mr. Magruder. My comment kind of dovetails on some of the points your guest made earlier. I can't remember where it was, but it was a while ago. I saw a speech he was giving to some type of youth conference on C-SPAN. And okay. There was a lot of bright, educated young people in the audience, and he was sort of making the same type of comments about black entertainment the way it is now. And like you said, on the shucking and jiving kind of thing. And he said, if you want America to see you in a different light, you have to start taking responsibility for yourself. And I think one of the reasons his criticism works is because he's not just another angry young black man shouting at the wilderness. He comes, he's well-educated, and he's very even-keeled, very composed, and he comes at it...
And very tough.
not from any religious standpoint, but he comes at it more from a, all right, it's time to grow up and get on with things kind of viewpoint.
Yeah, got it. Brian, thanks very much for your call. Aaron, I wonder on that, on the hip-hop front, if you'll share a little bit of that critique with us. I mean, this is often presented as truth-telling, and we've had people on this show saying, look, there's a long vein of truth-telling that runs through this, and it's applauded for that. You're pretty tough on it. Why?
You know, because the whole thing about truth-telling is that, well, it's supposed to be true. The problem I have with a lot of hip-hop artists is that they're actually not living these experiences that they're talking about. You know, listening to hip-hop music, you'd think nothing changed in Americans' inner cities over the past 10, 15 years, which is just not the case. I mean,
what's the frame that's outdated here? What are the cues that no longer apply?
Well, there's a couple things. I mean, one, there's you know, the evolution of crack as a drug and where it was in 1986 as opposed to where it is in 2003.
That is much less
prevalent.
Yeah.
It's basically killed off all its users. Not to say that there's not a drug problem, but you know, there's a sort of social and political framework that's a little outdated in contemporary gangster rap.
Of the drug scene and the gangster scene is smells stale to you.
There's no question it is stale. Mm-hmm. But that's not as egregious as on a personal, individual level, rappers claiming to have lived experiences that they never lived, to claiming to be from places that they've never lived, to talking about experiences which didn't exist. It's fiction. It's completely fiction. And it's an interesting thing, partially because the mantra of rap music for so long has been keep it real, and it's...
Right.
For so many, not all, but for many, it's the farthest thing from real. And also you have to remember that even those who did live those experiences, who were actually in the drug game, who did actually go to jail, and there are some of them, at the moment in which they're actually successful rappers and they're actually making these records, most of their days are spent with accountants and lawyers.
Yeah.
And
at the role,
you know, or in the booth, you know, rhyming or you know, hanging out and partying with women, and they're not exactly still on the run from the cops.
But it's so popular, and we saw just last week, you know, all black artists on the top 10. Not all hip hop, but most of it hip hop.
Nine were hip hop,
and so popular, not only of course in the black community, but right across racial lines. How do you interpret that popularity?
Well, what happened was, you know, the first rap group to really start to achieve a considerable amount of crossover appeal, a legitimate rap group. I'm not talking about, you know, sort of the sort of syrupy sort of bubblegum rap. I mean, the first real rap group to really get a large crossover audience in the white suburbs was Public Enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very aggressive and very militant, but also very political. And when N.W.A. came along very shortly thereafter and had all of the aggression and all of the violence, even much more violence, with none of the politics, it actually reached a much, much larger white audience. And that has really been sort of the critical turning point in black culture. And that was, I mean, that was like 1989, really, when they started to get popular. So we're talking about 14 years.
Aggressive, political. It sounds a little bit like Aaron Magruder. Do you share something with Public Enemy and that hip-hop group?
Yeah, certainly, you know, a large amount of my work is inspired, not just by Public Enemy, but where hip-hop was in the years between 1987, 1988, and 1992. That was a very sort of overt political black nationalist era in hip-hop music at a time when I was in high school and, you know, sort of just learning about the world. But what we have seen since then is you know, over a decade of creative stagnation in black art, particularly black music. And it, you know, we're still basically in the gangster rap era to this day.
And Aaron Magruder and the Boondocks say enough. Diedrich's calling from Boston. Hi, Diedrich. You're on the air.
Hey, Aaron. I want to say hi. Grew up in the place that I like to think was the model for the Boondocks, and went to school with Aaron. And don't want to
wait, Diedrich Dunbar.
Yeah.
What's up, man?
What's going on, man?
we went to high school together.
Was that in Columbia, Maryland?
It was.
That is correct.
Okay.
That is correct. And I wanted to say to Aaron that I love the politics. I like to think of myself as a little Huey when I was in, an older Huey in high school and these things. But I do miss being a black son of a white woman. I miss some of the characters like Mariah, and I miss Tom, and I hope some of those people come back to deal more with the kind of racial issues that happen in these suburbs. And I also like to say that I think one thing doesn't get played enough about Aaron Stripp is that he's not scared to put out jokes that he knows not everybody's going to get. I'm always amazed at how many of white liberal political people who read it just to hear good insults against Bush, when they read it, they have no idea some of the jokes Aaron's making concerning hip-hop.
Do you recognize the hometown when you read the strip?
Definitely, yeah. The whole Timothy Lane thing. Exactly. No, I've always loved it because it reminds me of home. It reminds me of the experiences we've gone through. And it's really incredible going across the country, seeing how many people are touched by it, who even have no relation to that experience but can still identify with what Aaron's put together. So I just want to give a shout out to you, Aaron, and
thank you, sir.
Good to hear your voice.
I'm glad you two were able
man,
to connect here. That's great. Diedrich, thanks so much for calling. Martin's calling from Mansfield, Massachusetts. Martin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hello to your guest.
Hi.
You remind me of Tom Nast from the 19th century, whose comics virtually revolutionized American politics and, if I have my history correct, brought down Tammany Hall.
Wow. Well, that's a fine compliment. Thank you very much.
Well, you know, I mean,
I would like to take credit for revolutionizing American politics and bringing down.
Well, you know,
bringing down somebody.
Time will tell.
What he did is you know, with his cartoons, he essentially turned on a nation to what was going on, you know, in America when too few people could read. Now today, too few people are reading newspapers, like you said earlier in the hour.
Yeah. But there it is. There is a deep tradition, of course, of cartoonists sometimes delivering the really sharpest blows. And Martin, thanks for that call. Aaron Magruder, Michael Moore writes the foreword to your book, and he says there, Aaron serves up and sends up life in America through the eyes of two African-American kids who are full of attitude, intelligence, and rebellion. Each time I read the strip, I laugh, and I wonder how long Magruder is going to keep this gig going. What's your sense of that? Is there a buzzsaw waiting for the Boondocks and Aaron Magruder, or you've gotten away with it for this long? Have you sort of cut out your path and you're on it and you're not going to be unseated?
Well, look, you know, I'm a 29-year-old black man with the circulation of 20 million a day. It can end at any time. And I've always approached it as though it can end at any time because it's such a remarkably rare thing. That said, the nature of comic strips is such that if you can survive the first couple of years, it'll probably run till after you're dead, literally.
And has there ever been a moment where you began to write something into your strip and you just checked yourself and said, wait a minute,
certainly,
can't go there?
Certainly. No, there's no question. It happens all the time. Look, I think people don't understand what a confining place newspapers are, and I'm glad they don't because it means that I'm able to get new ideas through. But make no mistake about it, you know, there's a lot of things I can't say, and there's a lot of things I stop myself from saying.
Well, we'll keep reading. Aaron Magruder, thanks for the strip, and thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Aaron Magruder joined us from Culver City, California. He is creator of the comic strip The Boondocks, and his new collection of Boondocks strips is A Right to Be Hostile, and it is, and funny too. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onepointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, one man traces his life through the comics. This is On Point. When Rhode Island resident Daniel Orenstein looks at the daily comics, he sees a roadmap of his life. In this radio diary, Orenstein says he recently found himself laughing out loud at the funny pages, and it made him realize he's well on his way to middle age.
I laughed and brought the comic strip to my wife. She laughed and said, "It's perfect." I cut it out and put it on my refrigerator, the first strip to ever have received such an honor in my house. Only after I had gone through this ritual did I realize the absurdity. I was laughing at the family circus, a strip that has been around since I was a kid and which had never so much as elicited a chuckle out of me. The neat, usually single-framed strip features four never-aging youngsters constantly providing cutes and frustration for their tired but never at wit's ends parents. By laughing at the family circus, I was suddenly reminded that, like it or not, I'm 35 years old with a wife and two kids who provide constant cutes and frustration. I remember the family circus as a kid. I would only read it because, well, there was usually not much to read. It was mostly pictures. But there was also nothing particularly funny about it. I went straight for Peanuts, where I could follow the trials of Charlie Brown and Linus or enjoy Snoopy's single-minded pursuits of food and relaxation. In fifth grade, my best friend introduced me to Garfield, the cool cat who had the run of the house with his easily duped owner and his slobbering sidekick, Odie. By high school, I invigorated myself with the thought that being a Bloom County fan was the equivalent of being really smart. Bloom County had politics, pubescent insecurities, social commentary. What better for the budding pseudo-intellectual? And then, of course, came the Doonesbury phase, coupled with the Far Side. They were perfect for the first year in college. Doonesbury covered the world of current events with a comforting liberal commentary. The Far Side complemented my own academic pursuits in the life sciences. A couple years later, Matt Groening's Life in Hell captured my cynical turnaround on the life I had chosen for myself. And, of course, Life in Hell would set up my entire generation for a good decade or so dose of the sarcasm of The Simpsons. So here I am, looking again and again at the new family circus adorning my refrigerator. Frame one features the four kids contently playing with balls, dishes, and teddy bears on the far side of an empty room. Mom enters the opposite side of the room to do her ironing, but by frame two, all of the kids are engaging in the exact same activities as before, but this time within a 2-foot radius of frustrated mom trying to work. It's not just that I've rediscovered a comic strip that has been around forever, but hasn't been funny until now. It's that comics have reminded me that I am getting older. My life is changing, and things that once weren't funny at all are now hysterical. I can still get a rise out of Peanuts or Garfield or The Far Side. But now, when I try to enjoy a little bit of Simpsons on Fox, I'm uneasy that my children are sitting next to me. I didn't like the fact that they started running around the room screaming, "My butt is on fire," the last time we watched the show together. I wish they would choose Peanuts or the Family Circus cartoons over The Simpsons, at least for the duration of their childhood.
Daniel Orenstein is working on his PhD at Brown University. He lives in Providence, Rhode Island. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Sarah Cook. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.